Weather Brains episode number 377 for April 15th, 2013. Ooh, this is tax day. Just noticed that. Oh, boy. I owed a little bit this year, and I filed at the last minute, but I did press the button on TurboTax Online last night, authorizing the federal government to take money out of my bank accounts. So that's always exciting. So, let's go around the horn. We're missing one, I see. Kevin Selly is absent. There's a little weather. There was weather in North Texas. He had one storm, but it's dissipated. He probably worked so hard on that one storm, he had to go to the green room and get some grapes and sparkling water, whatever they drink in there. But we got Brian Peters, the internationally beloved meteorologist, former government employee, former WCM warning coordination meteorologist, and who is standing by to tell us what's on his mind.
It's a blank slate. I'm just happy for the rains we had to get rid of some of this pollen, this yellow crud.
Yep, but I'm hearing it almost sounds like an amateur radio transceiver in the background. That's, I don't know where that's coming from. Oh, Seth, you got a 20 meter SSB radio going in there?
I don't know, but I hear something too.
Okay, yeah, we're not so sure what that. We need to do a ham radio extravaganza on this show one night where we're just going to peg the geek meter and do some serious ham radio. I would love to do that. But anyway, Brian is with us, and I noticed that Kevin Selly just joined us 3.7 minutes late.
Very busy over here, and you're doing what?
You had one storm, and it's
ago.
Gone
one
now.
One storm so an you, hour ago.
Yeah,
and if you'd let me finish. You've startled me by starting the show on time.
Whatever. Yeah, no. That never happens. That's true. I'll give you that. So, well, you had one storm out there and it died. So is that
there
it for
a couple,
the night?
Yeah,
done?
We put down some good hail. We had some ping pong balls in a couple of spots northwest Ooh. Of Dallas. But, yeah, they have kind of pooped out and the watch has been taken out. So we're just waiting on the cold front. Well, northwest Texas will see some dry line stuff on Tuesday, but pretty hefty cold front coming late Wednesday into Thursday.
Yeah, it looks like Wednesday might be a big day for Oak City? Yeah, Tulsa.
Rare day three moderate risk.
Yeah. A lot of people buzzing about that today.
Got that 45% hatched zone on day three. That doesn't happen very often. So we'll talk about that. We a lot to talk about. We've got a lot of news. This has been kind of a newsy week involving weather. We have the world's greatest weatherman. This man worked for the National Weather Service for 32 years at one station. He retired in the late 80s. He is still growing strong, and he has more sense than everybody else on this show combined. J.B. Elliott. J.B., how are you?
You have me mixed up with somebody, but I'm doing fine.
But more importantly, what you have for lunch today?
It's a long list. Let me read it. I had one dish of Campbell's celery soup and five Ritz crackers and a diet ginger ale.
I bet you we could probably poll, 10 million Americans. You're the only one that had that combination for lunch. But it's great to have you back, JB, and glad you're here. We have Nate Johnson from Raleigh, North Carolina on the line. Nate, how is your Monday? By the way, we should mention, too, this was kind of a tragic day. You told a fascinating story about a station employee that was in Boston for this marathon. And, of course, we had bombing today.
Our morning anchor is a marathoner and a long-distance runner, and she qualified. The Boston Marathon is not one of these things you can just walk up and enter. You actually have to qualify. And she qualified, actually finished the race today. She ran it. And during our noon newscast, we do an hour-long noon, and leading into weather in the 12:30 half hour, we had a chance to talk to her as she was running. She was crossing mile 24 while we were talking to her on the phone. It was very cool. And, of course, had no idea of what was to come, but she crossed the finish line, finished 297th. Out of roughly 15,000 women runners. So then she's good. Her name's Kelsey Carlson. So she runs the race. She finishes, gets in the car, and is heading back to the airport because she's going to fly back and is going to be at work later this week. and hears about the bombing and turns around and goes back downtown and is filing reports for us this afternoon after we got in touch with her, made sure she was okay. Just, you know, just in case you thought you had it and thought you could do it all, this woman runs 26.2 miles and then goes to work. Before she goes to work, she just runs a marathon, just, you know, for fun. It was very interesting for about 20 minutes this afternoon. Everybody in our newsroom had just a small taste of what it was like for the friends and family of the 15 or the 30,000 runners and all of the people downtown in downtown Boston who were wondering about their loved ones and wondering whether or not they were okay and all that kind of stuff. Very interesting to be put on the other side of that. And I think hopefully gave us a sense of what that was like. But thankfully she's okay and is the Iron Woman that we knew she was. And we'll be good to see her when she gets back to town later on this week.
Wow.
Wow, what a story. I could not imagine running that far and having to actually go to work and do some journalism. That's unbelievable. Hey, but before we bring in Bill, hey, JB, is by chance the television on in your room?
It's on mute.
Okay. I'm trying to see what you guys see. I'm hearing it sounds like a radio or a television coming down somebody's channel here, but that's okay. We'll figure it out.
I'll tell you what,
Bill Murray.
Let me
is
turn
here.
It off. It's on Fox News. Oh, boy, she's pretty.
Title. Well, that's why they hired her. Oh, wait. I didn't say that out loud.
Oh, boy. You know, one thing about JB at his age, he doesn't care. He is totally politically incorrect. It doesn't matter. You know, we still have a little bit of a filter here. Okay. Yeah, it's just something else. We'll figure it out. All right, Bill Murray, you take it away and you bring in our special guest star.
Yeah, James, a sad day today following all the news coverage. But anyway, we'll press on. And tonight we have a very special guest, Weather Brain. He's a suggestion of a listener, which we love those listener suggestions. John McCoy, who lives in Xenia, Ohio, which is a very famous tornado town, suggested that we have this gentleman on tonight. He's been the science and operations officer at the National Weather Service office in Wilmington, Ohio, for the past 3.5 years. He had prior National Weather Service positions, including a meteorological intern in Aberdeen, South Dakota, a journeyman forecaster in the Twin Cities, senior forecaster in La Crosse, Wisconsin. He was born and raised in Upper Sandusky, Ohio, and we're going to talk about a Sandusky later tonight, but it won't be the one in Ohio. He also attended Iowa State, got his BS in meteorology there in 1999. He, of course, manages the Office of Science and Training Programs, like Kevin Laws does here in Birmingham. He's starting his 15th year in the NWS, married two kids, 10 and 6, loves traveling, outdoor sports and activities, and being a dad. Seth Bonneau, welcome to Weather Brains.
Thanks, guys.
You know, and really the reason that John thought we should have you on the show tonight, there were a lot of reasons, but he was fascinated by a presentation that you did last year or maybe earlier this year on the June 29th, 2012 derecho, which, you know, was a major system. Talk about that storm and its scope and impact for a minute.
Well, for our area in particular, it was a storm with a huge amount of scope and impact. It was pretty much a direct hit on our forecast area and arguably at peak intensity. If you remember that derecho, 91 miles per hour measured at Fort Wayne was the top measured wind speed, and that's just northwest of our forecast area. And so it came in between 3 and 7 p.m., and we had just tremendous instability, one of the most unstable soundings I had ever seen when we did the 18Z special sounding there from our office. So the whole forecast area had impact, and we had numerous reports of 70 to 85 mile an hour winds and a lot of power outage, a lot of infrastructure impact. It was a big deal. One of the bigger events that I've worked in my career.
Now, your office covers a little bit of southeastern Indiana, a little bit of northern Kentucky, and a good bit of southwestern Ohio. Is that right?
That's correct. About 52 counties total, the majority of those in southwest and central Ohio, the Columbus metro area and the Dayton metro area and the Cincinnati metro areas are our three big cities.
So Xenia, where our friend John lives, is an important town in tornado history in that area, for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not only for the F5, which we just celebrated the 39th anniversary of back on, I think, April 3rd of 1974, but also had the EF4 there within the last 10 years. I think it was in the early 2000s there in Xenia. So Xenia's been hit twice. Certainly the first time around was the more devastating, and then certainly in terms of fatalities.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Seth, but I remember that this derecho had its germination in a single thunderstorm. Is that right?
It evolved out of a very small cluster of elevated thunderstorms in eastern Iowa, really nocturnal thunderstorms that developed 3-4 in the morning and then moved into northern Illinois and then across the Chicago area, where it became surface based just east of the city of Chicago. And from there on out, and that was late morning, it really took off. It joined with a separate cluster coming out of northern Indiana, and that evolution across northern Indiana into our area was really where things started to get going big time.
Now, I don't remember this specific event until it got well into the afternoon and was moving into the mid-Atlantic. And so was it a very well-forecast event by the models and by your forecasts in your office?
No, not at all. And that's what was so interesting about this event. The predictability of it was quite poor. And I think, in general, derechos, for the most part, are very low predictability convective systems. I think they're one of the biggest challenges we have in convective forecasting, especially the midsummer derechos that form on the north side of the upper ridge, and some people call them the ridge riders. Very difficult to forecast, almost from a synoptic forcing standpoint, very, very weak forcing, but usually right on the edge of the cap with tremendous instability, and the right combination of ingredients comes together and they can get going. But we do see it in the Great Lakes, coming out of elevated thunderstorms in Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and then running down through the Great Lakes about once every couple summers. And this one in particular was a doozy, and we took a direct hit from it.
So you were talking about that sounding from the 18Z special balloon that day. What sort of capes were you running?
Surface base, we measured over 6,000, I think 6,200.
Wow.
It was, well, I think when I released the balloon that day, it was 97 over 75, and that was about 2 hours in front of the derecho. So I think we warmed close to 100 with mid 70 dew points that day. It was really a new, unique environment.
So there was some anticipation that this thing would weaken as it got ready to cross the Appalachians, right? But that didn't happen, did it?
That didn't happen. There was a great amount of destabilization on the other side of the Appalachians. And if you watch, you know, a real high-resolution satellite loop and watch the derecho as it crosses, it does weaken. The cloud top's definitely warm. And when you see it hit the other side of the Appalachians in that pool of instability in the Baltimore-Washington corridor, the I-95 corridor, you can see the cold cloud tops just erupt. And it re-strengthens further. But that was the big question all along for Storm Prediction Center and the offices along the East Coast. How was this storm going to make it across the Appalachians? Would it make it across the Appalachians? And getting back to the predictability, you know, we watched the setup for days in advance, and it was a great derecho type environment in the Great Lakes. If you go back and look at some of the analogs to derechos in the Great Lakes, the pattern we had that day was just a perfect derecho environment, but our models just did not pick up on the forcing. And, you know, every couple, three runs, you get a weak convective cluster in the NAM and or maybe one in the GFS. But it wasn't until the morning of the derecho and we started picking up the experimental 3-kilometer HER. Had a couple of runs with an intense convective system coming right through the forecast area where we really sat up and took notice that this was going to be a significant event.
Now, the Weather Service did a service assessment after this system, right?
That's correct.
Was that the first time one had been done after a derecho, and what did it reveal?
Well, I'm not certain if it's the only one that's been done after a derecho. It could. I don't recall any in my recent memory of one that would have been done after a derecho, but I think what it revealed was predictability of these systems, and these, especially these MCS, damaging wind MCSs, are very, very difficult. In these experimental convective allowing models like the HER and some of the other ones, the wharfs that are running in various locations are really important for us to gaining confidence. And certainly when you look at like SPCs running the SSEO, Ensemble of Opportunity for severe storms, those are the type of tools that help us, especially in the short term, get a better sense of the probability of these occurring on a shorter time scale. But when you think of what emergency managers need from a preparedness standpoint, you know, 2-3 days notice, derechos really push that. They push our ability to predict these systems, you know, that far in advance. And it's really a meteorological challenge for us, considering the scope of the impact that they can cause. So it's a big hurdle for us in the coming years.
Now, were you using any sort of enhanced wording in the warnings, or do you recall any of the other offices that were affected by the system doing that?
We did. We saw the 91 measured out of Fort Wayne, and that the trajectory of that part of the derecho looked like initially it was going to move a little bit north of our area. But when it hit our first county and we got a report of some pretty significant damage, it was from there on out, we really elevated the wording in our warnings and tried to, you know, raise awareness as quickly as possible in that manner. But it was moving extremely fast, 60 to 70 miles per hour. So I think it took a lot of people by surprise, just the, you know, how strong the winds were and how quick it came up on a lot of people.
Well, I think the death toll ended up being pretty high in this deal, didn't it, Seth?
I believe they said 28 to 30, I think, is what the last numbers I saw, which is, you know, that's a, when you consider, 4 million people without power and 30 fatalities, that's in the middle of a heat wave. I mean, this was a really intense heat wave that this occurred in the middle of, and to lose power for 5 to 7 days, or, you know, people that are sensitive to heat, elderly, people don't have access to air conditioning. That's a big, big deal. So there was a lot of big impact, indirect impact from the derecho when we lost power over such a huge part of the eastern United States in the derecho path.
Hey, Seth, can you expand on that from the public standpoint? Because, you know, I mean, a tornado is a bad thing, but we kind of know about those. And people that are prone to them, yes, it can be very devastating. But this is sort of different. Can you talk about both during and after what your perceptions were of the public reaction to this?
I think both, you know, during, before and during, even though we started to ramp up our wording and in our hazardous weather outlooks, we started to talk about severe storms and high wind producing thunderstorms. I don't think we conveyed the message as clearly as, and again, this goes back to predictability. We weren't certain 6 hours before it happened that we were going to have a storm of this magnitude and of this, you know, widespread magnitude covering multiple counties. Like you say, a tornado track is a half mile wide and could be any distance long, but something like this that's multiple counties wide and 70 to 80 miles per hour wind, and the nature of the damage and the widespread nature of the damage and the power loss. The comments that we read in the service assessment from a number of people were just, we had no idea it was coming, or if we didn't know it was coming, we had no idea it was going to be that strong. We had no idea it was going to be that intense of a windstorm. And I think that's what makes derecho so unique, is they take your regular wind producing MCS and they take it all to another level in terms of impact. And then afterwards, I don't think people got the sense of just how widespread the tree damage was and the difficulties, especially for the rural co-ops, the rural power companies, to get into these isolated areas and fix the number of power poles down and the huge amount of tree damage on top of power lines. That's a lot of work, and it's a lot of work in 95 degree heat on top of that. So you've got the safety of the people restoring power and then a very nervous and a very impatient public wanting their air conditioning back. And day after day after day, and it grows and it grows and it grows. And you know, by the end of the, you know, a week, you end up with a lot of unhappy people and a lot of people that just really don't understand how strong and impactful these events can be.
You mentioned the wording and prepping. There's been a lot of discussion here in North Central Texas, Council of Governments, Weather Service, to the use of the term tornado emergency. Is there some discussion buzz going on that's a higher level of, you know, wording for wind or these types of events?
Not that I've heard. And that's an interesting idea, you know, that the tornado emergency, that's an interesting topic because in March 2nd, 2012, with the tornado outbreak here in the Ohio Valley, which was part of the larger outbreak down into the southern United States as well, that was our first tornado emergency as well that we issued from our office. And I think we've still got, even with tornado emergency, we've got work to do there in educating people what that means, because some of the feedback we received to our office and both during that event and after that event was, you're using this word and not everybody is really understanding what this means. Despite our efforts to educate, it is a newer term. And even some of our law enforcement and dispatch that we contacted during the event that, you know, this was moving to a tornado emergency situation, we had to double check with them to understand, make sure they understood what you know, the gravity of that, you know, verbiage in our product. So I think there's a lot of education that still needs to be done on both tornado emergency and any other new product type impact wording. It's only good if people know how to interpret it and act on it.
Now, Seth, that was not the first big event of the year for you guys, because you had experienced a large outbreak earlier in the year, right?
Yeah, that was the March 2nd outbreak. Two big events within 4 months of each other. I've been in the Weather Service 15 years, and to have two events like that within 4 months was unique. I'd never experienced that before. So March 2nd, tornado outbreak, biggest tornado outbreak in our office's history since it opened. Certainly looking back to 1974 and the super outbreak, there had been bigger tornado outbreaks. But this one only encompassed about a third or a fourth of our CWA, and especially just the northern Kentucky counties. The tornadoes did cross over the Ohio River into southern Ohio. But just a smaller part of our forecast area, but 10 tornadoes and 11 fatalities and an EF4, which was, we hadn't seen a tornado that strong in quite a while. So it was a big event for us then too.
Now, you mentioned, Seth, that the tornado, that the F4, I think, passed very close to the Covington or the Cincinnati airport radar, right?
Yes, it did. It passed within 6 miles. The forward flank of the supercell, which was actually producing large hail, passed right over the radome, which the TDWR radars are 5-centimeter radars, and they attenuate very easily and significantly. So despite the attenuation, we got some tremendous near storm imagery in the 1 minute resolution from that Cincinnati TDWR. And it was remarkable after doing the damage surveys to go back, not only to see the radar imagery in real time, but then after doing the damage surveys to come back and to piece it all together, to put the damage tracks with the radar imagery in that 1 minute resolution and see the cycling of the rear flank downdraft and the tornado genesis and how quickly that process spun up, spun down. We had a break in the damage and then it spun up another EF3. You could see all those features on the TDWR in tremendous clarity. And it's really made for some fascinating research that we've done in our office on, you know, certainly the CASA radars and some of those mobile, you know, Dow radars and research radars in the planes capture some of, make this stuff look like coarse resolution. But for what we saw in real time, it was pretty impressive in comparison to what we normally see on the 88D.
So you got a little preview of the future. Sure, radar there, and use it. So hopefully you're going to make a nice paper about that for the NWA meeting in Charleston. Will you be able to be there, given what's going on in the federal government?
Boy, oh boy. We just don't know. There's so many unknowns right now, and none of it sounds very good. But we're not going to let it stop us. We're working on some abstracts for NWA right now in the office. if it comes to be that we can't be there, we can't be there, but we can't let that stop us. We got to keep the ball rolling. So we're going to go forth and hope something happens where we're allowed to go. But it's definitely an uncertain time on the Weather Service.
So what are the furloughs and the sequestration? What does that mean for your standard forecast office in terms of how many shifts do you lose? What sorts of services might have to be cut back on? I mean, I know the public answer, and I totally get why this is that, you know, the public does not need to worry about, you know, we're going to get the warnings and all that kind of stuff. But what's for you guys working in the office, what does this mean for you in order to make that happen?
That's a great question, and I wish I could answer you right now, but I can't. The furlough news just hit at the very end of the day today, and that's something we didn't want to see. But one thing, and you're right, one thing that will happen is we're going to move forward and make sure there's not a lapse in service, and do our best to make sure that there's no lapse in service. We'll find out eventually what we need to do to make that happen. I don't have those details right now. But I anticipate we'll all need to pitch in a little more and help cover shifts and do what needs to be done to both meet the fiscal requirements of the sequestration and the furloughs, but meet the mission and why we show up to work every day. So I don't know. I think a lot of Weather Service employees tonight are kind of looking in the future and saying, what's going to happen? But if I know Weather Service employees, they're going to, you know, keep doing what we've been doing the last for however long and keep meeting that mission.
Now, with the furloughs, what does that mean? How many days off will folks have to take, pay unpaid, and what over what time frame, or is that known yet?
I've been told 4 days of furlough, which basically means you don't come into work and you're not paid for it. How we manage that and keep operations moving, I'm sure we'll be able to figure something out. None of those details are, you know, with this being so new, I don't have any details on how that'll come through, but that's what the number's been given to me at this time.
And that's 4 days over this between now and the end of the year, or
I believe net between now and the end of the fiscal year. Correct.
Okay. All right. And the part of that, as my understanding, was basically a complete ban on travel, at least initially, or
that I don't know the exact details there, because there's variations from different regional offices within the Weather Service. I know travel within my office has been cut back, but we are still doing some, you know, spotter training and things like that. So it's not that we're absolutely not allowed to travel, but certainly travel to conferences is something that's been, you know, more limited in the last year. So I would expect things like that to continue to be limited as we try to, again, meet those fiscal responsibilities.
I'm chairing a conference, and I have a number of federal employees on my program that I'm looking forward to hearing about and hearing from, and unfortunately I may not get to see them, which is, I think, bad for me personally, and I think it's bad for the science, and obviously nothing you can do about that, being where you are. It's something, though, that Andy Bailey, who's at the Pleasant Hill, Kansas City office, gave a presentation at one of the first integrated warning team workshops. And he said that there's a difference between your typical Weather Service employee and a lot of other, not to stereotype government employees in general, but the stereotype in this case does arise from, you know, a lot of folks are there. They're there to get a paycheck. They're there, you know, in some cases because they really care about it. But for the most part, you know, meteorologists at the Weather Service are a passionate bunch of folks. They want to get the job done, and they're willing to cut through the crap to do it. And they're the kind of folks that would be doing that whether they work for the Weather Service or somebody else. And I think that's what's going to get the Weather Service through. Unfortunately, I think there's almost a cynical view that makes it like it's those kinds of agencies are easier to cut because you know the job's going to get done anyway. And it's going to get done by people that care and that want to do it and were willing to take that sacrifice, which drives me nuts. But
yeah, Yeah, and you're right, and it's been my experience that this group of people care. They want to get the job. That nobody wants to see any degradation or lapse in service. Mm-hmm. And you're right. And to me, as a science officer, there's nothing better than sharing science and going to mm-hmm. conferences and interacting with other scientists, whether they're other weather service personnel or they're media or emergency management or academic. There's so much to gain there. And webinars and all that stuff is great, but still there's a lot of great things that happen at conferences. The sideline discussions, the discussions over dinner, you kind of take what's presented at the conference and you move it into an informal setting, and that's where a lot of great ideas are born. So I hope whatever is happening right now doesn't stay for very long, because I would love to see us get back, get into the conferences and continue to do that, because I think so much valuable science gets exchanged that way.
And I think too, and I made this point before, but I think the challenge too is that so much of where we are as a science and as where the Weather Service is today is a result of investment that was made 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. I mean, the time scale to get a GO satellite in orbit is on the order of decades. Mm-hmm. And so cuts that we, and it's very easy for, government folks and management in general, not saying Weather Service management, but, capital management, to cut things that have a long lead time because they show up on the balance sheet today and you pay the pain for it 5, 10, 15 years down the road. And that's what I'm afraid of, is it's not we're going to suffer the degradation in the next couple of years, but we're giving up gains or opportunities for gains in 2020, 2025, 2030, where we could be looking at, I'm going to dream here, but a phased array radar under every tree. How wonderful would that be?
Sure.
We're not going to have that, because that kind of investment, in addition to the furloughs and the short term pain, is going to be very easy to cut those things down the line as well. And so, hopefully the folks that are moving the beans around are paying attention to that and aren't going to cut those things willy-nilly. But
yeah, I agree. And that's, that I think what scares me more, I didn't want to see the furlough notice and all that today. But when you think about the sequestration being, that's a long-term mm-hmm. Implementation plan. So this might be the beginning of a longer term cutback or a longer term reduction. And that actually scares me a little bit more than, what we've got going on this year, this fiscal year. So, it's an uncertain time, but we're going to, like you say, I think most Weather Service employees, especially all that I know, we're going to keep going and meet the mission and hope for the best.
Good deal.
Hey, Seth, how is dual pole radar implementation going in your office?
It went great. We upgraded at the very end of August last year. We didn't get to use it too much for convection. It seemed once we got it installed, convection kind of shut down, and we went through the winter with it. And just starting to get ready. We just had our first decent convective event a few days ago, and looking forward to a full convective season with the radar. It's going to be very interesting.
See, that's what happens. You upgrade and you don't have thunderstorms. It just goes away.
Well, and what you wind up having is thunderstorms while you're upgrading. That happened in Texas a couple weeks ago with the Dias Air Force Base radar. It seemed like every time they take that thing down, just pencil us in for a moderate risk of a tornado outbreak. You're going to get it.
Yeah, fortunately, we didn't have any of those issues when we did our upgrade. It was 4 very quiet days, and everything came back up great. We're excited to put it to good use. Boy, there's so much, and I'm actually doing a little talk for my staff tomorrow on some dual pole things, and we're learning so much, seeing all the stuff coming in from around the country. Mm-hmm. And
How do you do training, Seth? How does everybody in the office get trained on the dual pole products? Is this something where they just go online, or they go off somewhere? How's the training work?
It's all in-house resident. You know, back, this is something back 10, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, maybe before, they would have sent the forecasters to a resident school, maybe two-week resident school at Kansas City or Norman, Oklahoma. Well, now it's all done virtually. So it's all done in-house. And the Warning Decision Training Branch, a part of the Weather Service, created a very nice course, operations course. It's 8 to 10 hours of online training with reinforcement training via simulations, which we've been working through those, different cases from around the country, looking at different dual pole products. So we've wrapped all that up. All of our forecasters have been through the dual pole training. We're just finishing up some of the simulations. And now it's really taking what we, you know, as we go through an event, look at what happened, look at those products, and begin to learn. And there's been monthly webinars, both from our regional office and from the Warning Decision Training. There's just a lot of science sharing going on with dual pole. And like I say, the imagery coming back from across the country, there's a lot to look at, a lot to learn as we learn the strengths and weaknesses of these dual pole products.
Yeah, I agree that I've learned so much from the Sioux here in my market in the CWA here. But the first thing he'll tell you is that there's a lot to learn, even though we've been through multiple convective outbreaks with these things. One more note, Seth, and I know you probably got to go. I wanted to ask you, most of us here are television people. How is the Weather Service relationship with the television meteorology community there in Cincinnati?
We're always trying to get better. We work very hard to try to keep that camaraderie and build the partnership. And it's not just with Cincinnati, with Dayton and Columbus as well. So we actually have three major media markets, 12 channels, I believe, of media that we interact with. And we're kind of centrally located between those three, so we try to get them to come out, and we held a dual pole workshop for them a little while ago, and that was very well attended. I was really pleased to see so many of them come out for that, and we've gone down to the different media or metro areas and met with some of the stations and had seminars down in those major metro areas as well. So it's all about communication and working with them, listening to feedback. You know, when we don't do something right, what can we do to improve it? How can we get them to broadcast our message the way we want it broadcast? And it's a really unique partnership to have those three major media markets and the spectrum of experience and knowledge among the television meteorologists is just unbelievable. I mean, you really do learn a lot interacting with all of them. So it's a great environment.
Are you using the National Weather Service chat during severe weather or active weather with those guys?
Yes, we are. We were on the later side of getting into NWS chat. But since we've been on, it's been very rewarding for us. And I think it's been rewarding for our media partners as well, because we see them jump in and the volume of storm reports that we're getting from our media partners is just tremendous. And that's, you know, we couldn't be more thankful of that. That's how it all works. It's just a great flow of information back and forth.
And one more thing, tell us about the social media use of your office there.
That's an ever-growing area, and one we've actually invested a lot of resources in. I'm actually part of the social media team in our office, and we've got some really energetic guys leading that. We've seen our Facebook presence grow and our Twitter presence, and we're still learning and feeling our way of how best to get information through that medium and what's really going to be a piece of information that gets passed around and used. So we're learning as we go with that. I'm really pleased with a lot of our content that we've got on our Facebook page, and our Twitter presence has been rapidly growing. We see it with every convective outbreak or every big storm. We get a lot more followers. So it's you know, we only got our accounts activated, you know, year and a half ago. So it's still an area that we're growing through, and I really like the trend. We've got people on board in our office, and the content is really neat. It's an exciting area for us.
Great. Well, Seth, thanks a lot for taking the time to be on the show this week. If anybody wants to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that? Twitter, email, what?
Twitter is, you know, my name, Seth Bienau, S-E-T-H-B-I-N-A-U, and then my email is seth.bienau@noaa.gov. So those are the best two ways, probably.
Hey, let me follow, since you mentioned Twitter and stuff, let me follow up. Are you getting any guidance or any directives from Washington on what you're supposed to do with social, or are they letting each office kind of creep their own way up?
There's a guidance on you know what should and shouldn't be done within Twitter, and some recommendations for, you know, what would be good information to pass. And because there's a whole bunch of different ways you can go. You can automatically post all your warnings and automatically post all your discussions and all your outlooks. And so they leave a lot of that up to the local office in terms of what do you want your Twitter feed to look like? What kind of content do you want to be there? They let a lot of it up to the local office to kind of find their way and see what kind of content they want to put in there. So yeah, there's been some pretty good guidance actually that we've been given in that area.
Okay.
And if you'd like additional guidance, Kevin there will be glad to help you, right, Kev?
Yes, as you know, I am a social media expert.
Yeah, there you go.
But anyway, you Seth, and everybody else
on the planet, that's right. Hey, Seth, thanks a lot for giving us 45 minutes and being on the show this week. You were a great guest, and thanks for the work you do up in that market, and keep it up.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having
Seth.
Me on.
Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Seth. All right, what we're going to do right now is pause, as we often do. We're going to have Weather Brains 101. We've got This Week in Weather History. We've got JB's Weather Roundup this week, which is going to be good. We'll have the Fog Bank. It's back. We've got Picks of the Week and much more as Weather Brains rolls along.
Weather Brains 101 with Professor Peters.
In our last episode, I spoke about changes to the definition of storms to allow the National Hurricane Center to continue with advisories even after a storm becomes non-tropical, all of which came about because of Hurricane Sandy. Well, there are other changes coming in hurricane products for 2013. The Tropical Cyclone Update, or TCU, product is a text product that provides notice of significant changes in a tropical cyclone that occur between regularly scheduled public advisories. Now, beginning in 2013, the TCU will also be issued to provide a continuous flow of information regarding the center location of a tropical cyclone when watches or warnings are in effect and the center can be tracked with land-based radar. This will eliminate the Tropical Cyclone Position Estimate product. Another big change comes in the Tropical Weather Outlook. It typically covered the next 48 hours, but will now cover the next 5 days. The Tropical Weather Outlook is a text product that describes areas of disturbed weather and their potential for tropical cyclone development. The information will be provided probabilistically in 10% increments and will supplement the 48-hour probabilistic formation potential already provided. The National Hurricane Center is currently developing a corresponding 5-day Genesis potential graphic that might also be available in 2013. The current graphical tropical weather outlook that highlights the location of areas of disturbed weather and shows the 48-hour probabilistic Genesis potential will remain unchanged. Now, one more important change comes to the size of the tropical cyclone forecast cones. They're shrinking. The cone represents the probable track of the center of a tropical cyclone and is formed by enclosing the area swept out by a set of imaginary circles placed along the forecast track at 12, 24, 36 hour, etc. intervals. The size of each circle is set so that 2/3 of historical official forecast errors over the previous 5 years fall within the circle. A table on the NHC website shows that the radii of the circles will be smaller by as little as 3 miles at 12 hours and by as much as 32 miles by 120 hours. For your weather questions, drop an email to question@weatherbrains.com.
News headlines on Sunday, April 15th, 1956, talked about Democratic presidential hopefuls Adlai Stevenson and Estes Kefauver and their attacks on President Eisenhower's foreign policy. Eisenhower still had a firm lead in recent polls that showed him a clear winner if he was to run against Kefauver. The UN Secretary General was in Lebanon working on the Israeli-Egyptian crisis. In baseball, Major League clubs were closing down their spring training camps and heading for Tuesday opening games. The Yankees and Dodgers were favored to win their respective pennants again, as in 1955. Locally, politician Jabba Wagner was running for Associate City Commissioner, Public Improvement. The Birmingham News put the official U.S. Weather Bureau forecast on the top of the front page back then. The paper called for considerable cloudiness, windy and warm conditions for Sunday and Sunday night with scattered showers and thunderstorms. Winds are expected to average 15 to 30 miles an hour. It sounded like tornado weather. It turned out it was. Around 3 p.m. that Sunday afternoon, an F4 tornado tore across the western and northern fringes of Birmingham. It touched down first just west of Wylam. It plowed through the McDonald's Chapel and Stacy Hollow areas. 100 homes were destroyed in these two communities alone. The murderous tornado continued through Sandusky, destroying 20 blocks of homes. It then hit the Sayreton area just north of North Birmingham, destroyed a filling station and a barbecue restaurant along U.S. 31 in Fultondale. Homes were destroyed in the New Georgia community between Sayreton and Lewisburg. The tornado passed just north of Tarrant City near Ketona. Finally, it lifted near Chalkville. Other neighborhoods that were hit hard that day were Capstown and Oak Ridge. A Capstown resident said that the tornado looked like a big ball of fire rolling in big black smoke. It just roared, roared, and roared, she said. The only warning anyone had was the sound of the tornado. The twister killed 25 people along its 20-mile path. Most of the deaths occurred in the Stacy Hollow and McDonald's Chapel communities, save for two young sisters who were killed in the Sandusky area. Over 200 people were injured and 1,100 left homeless. A total of 400 homes and buildings were destroyed. That's the story of a tornado that our own J.B. Elliott will remember clearly that occurred during This Week in Weather History. Follow my weather history tweets on Twitter. I am WXHistorian at Twitter.com.
So, JB, do you remember that tornado in 1956, April of 56? I was not alive back then. Do you remember that?
I certainly do.
I certainly do. You weren't working at the Weather Service yet, right?
No, I wasn't working at the Weather Service, but I was doing like Bill Murray. On Saturday mornings, I would catch a trolley or a bus out to the Birmingham airport and hang around the weather office all day, stealing their old weather maps and anything else I could get a hold of. And they were real nice to me and showed me around and helped train me some, but it would still be 2 to 3 years before I would get on duty there. But I do remember that particular tornado, and two of the most important forecasters there, besides Charles Bradley, the MIC, was Cecil Jobe. Any of you remember Cecil Jobe? And also Jerry Couard. Now, Cecil Jobe was an older guy, and he treated me real good and helped me train a lot. But when he talked, it was just like a PA system. He was so loud. And he did most of the weather broadcast on WERC radio every morning. And Davenport Smith was the anchorman on WBRC. I'm sure some of you remember him. And as far as I know, Mr. Jobe and his wife, they moved on to Clarksville, Tennessee after he retired, and I believe both of them have passed away, and I think both of Jerry Couard and his wife have passed away. But the reason I remember that, Cecil Jobe called me at home. He knew I liked pictures and asked me if I would ride up to the tornado damage area the next morning and take some pictures. So we went up there, and we went into the Stacy Hollow area first, and it was devastated. And we first thing we saw was a Channel 6 TV guy with a TV camera on a tripod, and he was sending back images to Channel 6 on Red Mountain. Of course, they were black and white at that time. But also, there was a policeman standing there, and Cecil Jobe asked if we could go in and told him where we were from. And he said, "You don't need to tell me where you're from. I recognize that voice anywhere." And so we spent much of the day in Stacy Hollow and McDonald's Chapel. I finally got my camera and struggled to go back up the west side of the valley, up a steep embankment to the top of the ridge and look down on Stacy Hollow and get a picture of all of Stacy Hollow, and also where it went up the other side, up the eastern part of the ridge, and disappeared. And I still have an 8x10 black and white print that I made from that many years ago. And as soon as I can dig into my tons of pictures, I want to find it and let Bill have it.
And I was trying to do the math here. JB, you were 24 years old in 1956, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Go ahead, Bill.
Now, JB, did that tornado go all the way into the bottom of the hollow there?
It sure did.
So there's that myth that that hollows and valleys are protected. That's blown away again by that, huh, JB?
It's a scam.
Sure was. On this one, it touched down on the top of the ridge on the west side of the hollow. And when it touched down, I don't know how violently it touched down at first, but by the time it got down to the bottom of the ridge into the hollow, it was full strength. I believe it was considered an F4 at that time. But it completely wiped out dozens of homes in the bottom of the hollow and many homes going up the eastern ridge. And even on top of the ridge, you could look up on the top of the eastern ridge and you could see about a 3/4 mile wide area where all the trees were gone.
Now, JB, when you think about all the tornadoes that have been through that general area, I mean, 1956, you know, 1973, you talk about, you know, Tarrant City and Center Point, you 77 with Smithfield, you know, and then 2011 and then 2012. Are there any others that come to your mind that went through that same northern and western part of Jefferson County?
And let's point out for those listening that those are suburbs of Birmingham, Alabama. Most people have no idea where those are. Go ahead, JB.
Yeah, I remember several other tornadoes, but I don't remember a specific tornado going through Stacy Holler and McDonald's Chapel before that.
Yeah, because 1998, too, which I left out.
Yes,
all right.
Sure.
Well, JB,
it
is your turn for the weather roundup. We're in the midst of April tornado season. So what's happening across the Great Fruited Plain today?
Okay, let me get my copy here and my magnifying glass.
By the way, I noticed all those books back there, JB. For those that are not watching, that are listening, JB, I see all these books. Is that a Hooters directory I see back there, JB?
I have several of those.
I love the fact that JB is man enough to own that.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Most people would just cower away from that, but JB's like, you know what? Not only is that a Hooters directory, but I got five of them on my shelf. What are you going to do about it?
He's a manly man.
Well, yes, he is.
JB's known gone to bed.
JB has known James the longest, so he can do that.
I have known James 40-something years.
Yeah,
but
at least.
When I go to church every Sunday and come back, I pass right by Hooters.
Oh,
but
yeah.
But I don't
start. JB has his Sunday school class socials in there, right?
Uh-oh. Yeah.
No, I don't even stop. I speed up, in fact, and shut my eyes. I've done some rear enders with my eyes shut.
There's your show title.
Rear enders with my eyes shut. It doesn't get any better than that.
That'll
end up drawing some new eyeballs through SEO.
Yeah, we might get explicit tags or something after that. I don't know.
Oh, man.
And then I get out on US 11 and speed up to 80 miles an hour.
All right, anyway, JB, the floor is yours. We'll stop the foolishness.
I'm crazy about books and magazines. I subscribe to about 35 magazines. I'm sorry to admit that. But I'm going to take a meat axe to those pretty soon. But most of those books in there have connections with my Sunday school. And I bought a $52 book from who's the great geographic publisher?
National Geographic.
Yes, that's right. And it's called Footprints of Jesus. And it's a real thick book, and it traces every place that Jesus went on earth and how long he stayed there and what he did. It's a very interesting book. And I have a lot of other books in there about meteorology and statistic books about everything around the world and some National Geographic big books that show all the atlases of the world, even North Korea.
And the Hooters directory on top of all of that. So there.
Yeah. Has anybody heard anything from North Korea today?
At this point, does anybody care?
No, I'm about to say
the news cycle was eaten up with Boston, too.
Yeah, after about five minutes
before the explosion, they announced that they were commencing military operations against the United States. So.
Oh, they've been saying that for the last, 20 years? I mean, come on. A bunch of bags of hot air.
I was hoping John Kerry could take me with him, and I would punch the little guy out.
J.B. Elliott starts international conflict with one punch. All right, J.B., let's do this weather roundup here before we run out of time.
I'm becoming more and more violent. I had my semi-annual heart checkup a couple months ago, and I had told my heart doctor that I wanted him to keep me alive long enough so I could vote for Hillary Clinton for president.
And JB better do this roundup before we get in big trouble here.
I went back over there 2 months ago, and I said, you cancel that request, because she got on TV the other day just warmly endorsing same-sex marriages. I'm hoping.
Oh boy.
She will now. Hope she will now.
JB, we better do this weather roundup before we get in way too much trouble. We are in such deep trouble now. I'm not. You better do the weather roundup.
You're gonna have to give equal time here on your James Spann 24/7 after this.
Yeah, I'm about to say this is going down the tubes fast. So let's do that weather roundup, JB.
You guys loosened my 1946 airwax. Okay. Nothing wrong with that. Anyway, I told him that I hoped Hillary would divorce Bill so he could marry Nancy Pelosi.
He's here through Thursday night, folks.
Tip your waitress, everybody. Yeah.
For those people ready to send the hate mail, it's JB@JBElliott.com. So please don't send it to us.
Yeah, okay. And and then Bill can marry the vice president.
JB, do the weather roundup, man. We are going
to... The highest in the country, Sunday was 98 in Laredo. We don't know what it was today. We'll get that report later.
I heard, JB, it was 102 again in Laredo.
Okay, let's say 102 in Laredo. That's where they used to have those 300 AM stations that went all the way to Alaska. Low this morning was -2 at Embarrassment. Minnesota, that's James's favorite town. Coldest in Alaska was 22 below at Alpine. Valdez now has 68 inches of snow on the ground, an increase of 8 inches the last couple of days. Birmingham, 22.30 inches of rain in the last, so far in 2013. That's 13.98 at the same time this last year. Excuse me. TV News today said that Texans were crying for rain and praying. Is that right, Kevin?
Absolutely.
Okay. And Nebraska is considered to be in an extreme drought despite all the winter snow. The flag is flying for most of Northwest and West Texas to have a moderate risk by midweek, and it looks like it's going to be another fire season because they have a red flag flying now. Winter weather is still ruling the northern plains, the upper Midwest, and New England. Winter warnings are... Even a blizzard warning was in effect today for parts of Wyoming, northwest Nebraska, all of South Dakota, and most of North Dakota and northwest Minnesota. Some of those places up there had received 27 inches of snow in the last 2 days. By midweek, Storm Prediction Center is looking at least a moderate risk for most of Oklahoma, southeast Kansas, including extreme southwest Missouri, and including Joplin, Missouri. Mr. Spann, real good friend and one-time co-worker at Montgomery's Channel 12, has been doing a real good job on the Weather Channel the last several days. They're still naming winter storms and have all 12 of those on the screen at the same time today. Gotta run.
I just don't quite know what to say about that segment. There's no doubt this show needs to be called JB Unplugged.
You got it.
if you get any complaints, forward them to me, and I will either answer them back or go punch them out.
Oh, boy. I'm telling you what, that's just, that's awesome. You got me so flustered here, I got to redo my soundboard here.
I was hoping Matthew would do it.
Did anyone else notice the tweet that came out just before the show from Brandon Daly? It says, after today, I need a lighthearted, shenanigans-filled episode of Weather Brains, and I think he probably got it.
Had you been here for the pre-show, Kevin Sella, you'd have heard me talking about that about the 9:25 Eastern.
Is that right?
Yeah. Just thought I'd put that out there.
Amazing things happen on the pre-show, Kev. All right, we got to roll on here and see if we've got the email in the old email inbox.
Letters. We get letters.
James Spann, we have breaking news.
We have breaking news. Stand by.
We interrupt this program for a CBS Radio Net Alert Bulletin.
This is for Daniel Lucas in Florence, Alabama. I got your email. There was more to that. No, he sends a link and he says, please confirm if you received this email. Daniel, I hope this serves as an acceptable confirmation. The email he sent was the folks at the University of Texas at Arlington have installed one of those gap-filling radars. They're in between Dallas and Fort Worth. So
yep.
Send us a link. We'll post that. Kevin, you know anything about that?
Yeah, I'll come up with a link that Larry Mowry, who's been on the program at Channel 11, did a little write-up on that thing. I'll see if I can find it.
Cool. So we'll get that posted here a little bit. He sent... sent us a link, though, with the video story from Channel 11. So good stuff there.
Before you move on, I got to say, with all the discussion of where news has gone over the past couple of years and what the internet has done, I don't think anyone has done any more to devaluate the idea of breaking news than this program.
Amen.
Ain't
a lasting contribution.
True. Yeah, yes. Ain't that the truth? All
I'm
right.
Sorry, go on.
No, that's quite all right. Folks have heard my call, and I appreciate this very much. A couple of weeks ago, we went through the email inbag, and we had no listener survey responses. And I'm glad to say that since then, we've gotten at least two per week. Please keep them coming. One from Kevin, who took the time to copy and paste. Sometimes, for whatever reason, it doesn't work. I mean, we're a low-budget show, and unfortunately, sometimes that doesn't quite behave the way it should. This is Kevin from Temple, Georgia, and he watches James's Weather Extreme video and has been watching the show since January of 2011. We haven't run him off yet. He does miss Kevin's Vuvuzela. So, Kevin, you need to bring that back.
They ruined it. There was an update to that Vuvuzela app, and they ruined it. It just made this little honking noise, and I have yet to find one. But now I guess I got to go back and look.
There you go. Also have another listener survey response from Lori in Lakeville, Minnesota. Minnesota, that's up to the north there, you know, up along the Canadian border. She has a bachelor's in meteorology and an MBA. Kevin, ooh, we need to talk to her. Maybe we can figure out how we can make some money on this show.
I'm sorry. Tell me again. I was trying to find that thing from Larry. I'm sorry.
She has her husband's a meteorologist. She's a meteorologist, and she also has an MBA.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's what we need.
Maybe we need to chat. So
somebody with common sense.
Yeah, well, and maybe somebody with more dollars than cents, or plenty of cents and dollars. But anyway,
that's great.
I graduated from the 4-H club.
Okay, that's good. I only have two H's in my name, so I'm only 2H. What does that give me? I have an update from John at controlgeek.net, the new update to the draft of standards for outdoor stage structures. You may recall a year and a half ago, Indiana State Fair had a thunderstorm wind gust come through, took down the stage, killed a couple of folks, and there was an outcry about needing some standards. And so he has sent along, we'll post a link to that on weatherbrains.com, but an update to that with some comments and a blog post about that updated standard. So hopefully that's coming along well. if you were up early on Sunday morning or up late Saturday night, you might have seen a very unusual local storm report from our friends in the Miami National Weather Service office.
Oh, yeah. This is too weird. This is just too weird.
So we're having some flooding down in the Miami area, and who should send a storm report but one King LeBron James, number six of the Miami Heat, reported significant street flooding in the Coral Gables area. This went down as an official storm report, and I would like to say that I copy clipped it and tweeted it. It was retweeted between the time I did it and the time I got out of church, about 3.5 hours or so. It was retweeted 50-some-odd times and was easily the most retweeted thing I have ever posted, ever.
Did he tag the Weather Service in the tweet?
No.
I have no idea.
He did Instagram pictures.
Oh, okay. So even better. And so I think that's what they relayed through. I'm not sure that he actually intended for the Weather Service to get it, but we're going to give him credit for it because it got there, and we appreciate that.
How did the Weather Service pick up on it? Are they watching his tweets?
They must be watching Instagram, because they pick it up.
You figure in a city like Miami, you've got some basketball fans, so, you know, whatever.
And we invited him on the show, Nate. So
we're waiting.
And I sought out the help of John Tuohy, you know, the meteorologist down there in Miami. And I wrote John this morning and said, you know, hey, I've tweeted King James, and I want to know if you know him, can you use your influence to get him on the show? He said, Bill, I have about as much chance of knowing LeBron James as you do of knowing Liberace.
All right. So, Anne from, I'm not going to say the city, but Anne T. from Florida was watching a television show recently, saw the alert sounded, a message began scrolling across the bottom of the screen, and the message started with, send us your severe weather pics and videos.
Oh, yeah.
But started
Ooh, yes.
with.
Yes,
yeah.
I inquired as to which station in this particular market. She said that she did not remember, she says seemed to be a very irreverent way of informing the public of serious risk. And I tend to agree. I think, you know, it's one thing to start the message with, you know, you first rule of emergency communication. And James, you the hams on this will know. If you're in a situation like that, you always talk about where first, then what. Because if you get cut off, you want them to show up. They'll deal with whatever they find when they get there, but you want them to get there. And there's an order of things that you communicate in emergency communications. And to start with essentially a help us out, as opposed to jumping right in, I don't know that that's appropriate. Now, I was hoping that she'd be able to tell me which station so that I could go and reach out and ask. Unfortunately, I don't know which station, so I can't reach out and ask them about that. But if anybody sees anything like that, I'd love to see that. I'd love to talk with whoever. I'm sure there's a reasoning for that. And I suspect it's one of those things where the meteorologist would prefer it one way and the promotions department from the station would prefer it another way. If that is what it is, then I'm not sure that we'd be able to fix it, but we may be able to bring down shame upon them using our little platform. So.
Yeah, we like to call out boneheads on this show.
Yes, we do. I have a link to some video of a very close to the TIV lightning strike from Michael W. Moss. We'll post a link to that on the website. I have an article. Get your buzzer ready, James. I have an article from Ken Meyer. Turbulence ahead. Dun, 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 dun. Climate change to cause bumpier flights and longer trips. And this is after, by the way, one of the most fascinating and quite frankly terrifying things I've ever seen in terms of weather research. Dark lightning.
Ooh.
So thunderstorms can produce this radioactive lightning that can hit you with more than a lifetime's dose of ionizing radiation in one flash if you happen to be close enough to it. And the good news is that most pilots fly away from any kind of lightning, and this kind of stuff lives with the bright lightning that we normally deal with. But anyway, the fact that we're, you know, things that I think Mike Smith keeps a list of all the things that climate change is blamed for doing, and that may wind up being, but who knows?
Be so, the first in your neighborhood to glow in the dark.
So I have two more emails I want to get through. One of them is sort of an informational. Mike Cox, a friend in Tennessee, was live tweeting Twister a couple of weeks ago. Most fun I've had on Twitter, by the way, a night before a morning show ever. It was great. And he got banished to Twitter jail.
Ooh.
Because he was retweeting a lot of folks who were tweeting in and really got the ball rolling to the point where it was written up in a couple of folks, couple of online outlets the following day. And as far as I'm concerned, it was his idea. He got it started, but got banished to Twitter jail as a result of tweeting. And here's what he found out. Can't tweet more than 1,000 times a day. I think we knew that already.
Right.
But he said that his last 100 tweets happened in the span of about an hour and a minute, which means he thinks that he got banished to Twitter jail for tweeting more than 100 times in a 60-minute period.
Wow.
So if that's the case, and I'd love to have somebody from Twitter confirm that, but it would be interesting to know if that is actually the case and what those guidelines are. If you're from Twitter, drop me an email, email at weatherbrains.com, or hit me up on the Twitter. And finally, I want to leave this as a discussion item. I know we're running short on time here, but a number of school systems, we had the Raleigh Integrated Warning Team meeting here in the central part of Central North Carolina where I am, and this came up as a topic in sort of some of our side discussions, but a number of Alabama school systems let out early and made this decision the day before, let out early in advance of a chance of severe weather. And I know that this has happened for some time, I think in large part after the Enterprise tornado a number of years ago. Very interesting to see what folks think about that. Is this, I mean, on the one hand, you have the issue of you don't want kids in buses when tornadoes are out there. And I think we all agree that's a bad thing. We don't want kids in school buses when there's tornadoes. But the question at that point is, do you keep them at school, recognizing that on the one hand, you're concentrating a bunch of kids into one place, and so an unlucky strike a la what happened at Enterprise could wind up killing people, or do you put them in buses early, send them home to what may be substandard housing, or not tornado safe housing? We have a lot of manufactured and mobile homes in that part of the country. In a lot of cases, it's the only way that folks can have a roof over their heads, and we're thankful for that. But we know that a lot of those homes are not safe during tornadoes. So I'd love to go around the horn and see what people think.
Well, let me start, because that happened in my market, and that was about a week ago. It was not one of these red letter day type severe weather events. It was a run of the mill severe weather event. We had a few tornadoes, had a few people hurt, no fatalities. But I don't think there's any right or wrong answer. That is a very hard issue, and you talk about our jobs being hard during severe weather. No matter what a school superintendent does, he's going to be inundated with hate mail. But the biggest problem we have in the rural systems, like you say, Nate, a lot of these kids, if they dismiss the schools and severe weather is expected, they send them home to a death trap, which is a mobile home. And I think for the schools that close, especially in these rural areas where a high population percentage lives in mobile homes, you've got to give the kids the option to stay at school because you don't want to send them home to a mobile home. And a lot of it is liability issues in what happened in Enterprise in 2007. I think the principal was a hero. If he wouldn't have sent those kids home, instead of the death toll being 7 or whatever it was like under 10, the death toll could have been 50, because kids aren't going to listen to the weather. These high school kids, they're going to go driving. They're going to go, play video games. And I think that guy was a hero. The media, these national media nitwits came down here and demonized that guy for being a moron, for sending, for keeping the kids in school when he should have sent them home. And as usual, it's these guys from New York or Los Angeles that don't understand tornado outbreaks. They don't understand safety. So, but still, a lot of the systems, and then there were lawsuits following that. A lot of the systems see that, and they just want to get rid of them. I think in some cases it's okay. In that case, the severe weather was going to come through some of the major markets about 3 in the afternoon, about the time the buses would run. If they get the lunch in, they send the kids home at 12:30 or 1 o'clock. That's technically a full day of school. So I don't think there's a right answer or a wrong answer. But I'll say this. Where the kids are sent home, they need the option to stay in a safe school building instead of coming home to a mobile home.
Kevin, what do you think?
I don't know that I can add to that. You know, a lot of times we go off and we look for the answer to things, and there just isn't one answer. And you get into case-by-case basis, and I think I just have to agree with James. I guess the only thing I might add is that maybe, and this is a tough thing too, but maybe if they're not going to be allowed to be at school, could there be some other types of community organizations or locations they could go to? But then you get into questions of liability and things like that. So it's a very difficult question.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a sticky situation because, like you said, there is no single right answer. And even within a school district, even within the bounds of a single school, there may not be a correct answer. You are a single correct answer, but I think I agree. It's the question of how do you deal with having a, you know, some kids go to the bus and how do you know which kids get on the bus and go home and which ones stay at school? Is that something that's decided early? And, yeah. You know, would parents feel pressured to sign their kids to send them home because they wouldn't feel, they'd feel somehow less for, you know, having to leave them at school, or would they even be able to pick them up, or that kind of thing? I mean, it really is an interesting thing. And it's interesting, too, that you mentioned that there was a service assessment that was done after the Enterprise tornado, and I incorporated that into my master's research. And one of the things that struck me about that was how out of their way I felt like the service assessment folks went to say the school did the right thing. I mean, that came up over and over again as I read through that service assessment. And I'm not passing judgment. I think they came to the right conclusion given everything we knew at the time. But it was very interesting that the service assessment, as much as it was there to assess the weather service's performance, really concerned itself with whether or not the school did the right thing, which is sort of outside the bounds. And it could be read as being outside the bounds of what the service assessment team was meant to do there.
Yeah, but I'll say this. Those people were heroes. There were teachers in there that protected those kids, that used their bodies to shield those kids. And nobody wanted to do a story on these heroes. These boneheads come down here from New York. They just lambasted the principal. You know, well, this guy was negligent because he should have sent them home and this tragedy would have never have happened. Joe Blow dried boob for, you know, CNN News. And they just stop it. Just if you don't know what you're talking about, don't come down here and do the story.
Who are those people from New York?
Just reporters. You know, they're down here. You know, the blow-dried boob guys coming down here, you know, trying to mock the school administration for not sending the kids home, where the truth is their decision saved a lot of lives. But we could this is a subject we could talk about for a long time, but we've got to move on here. Let's roll the fog back.
Let me make one quick point because it came up a couple of weeks ago at the event that I was at, because there was a school threatened and, in fact, damaged a year ago here. And one of the things that came up that Nate had mentioned is the parents. And I think something that we can all do is to remind parents, especially outside of an event, to just take a breath and think for a minute. Because during that same event, I think I've mentioned, you know, there was a tornado in Kennedale that was probably maybe close to 2 miles or so from where Matthew goes to school. And so we were personally involved with that, but we had parents trying to get to the school, which means they're out and about, they're putting themselves in danger. So again, there maybe isn't one right answer, but try and think about these things, especially in the event, and take a moment rather than just to react, but think about what you're doing.
And the problem is that 18 hours out, they're trying to get you to make decisions, and this system snuck up on us. Mm-hmm. You know, the Western Alabama MCV developed, you know, out of the blue virtually, and could have very easily caught those systems that were dismissing at late morning. You know, could have caught those buses on the road, you know, just when we didn't want them to be.
Yep. All right,
it was very interesting for me. Well, I want to make one more comment. Okay. It was very interesting for me that that this came up the same day as the Raleigh Integrated Warning Team workshop, because I was reminded again by how even for a borderline event, in this case we were sort of workshopping a winter event, how different groups have drastically different criteria for what triggers their actions. You know, for power companies, it might be a quarter inch of ice. For schools, it might be anywhere from nothing to a tenth of an inch of ice. The emergency management folks don't really care until it gets to be really more than a quarter to a half an inch of ice, because that's when it starts to become a big deal. And that, you know, you apply that to you know, tornadoes and winter weather and severe weather and everything else. And all of a sudden you're putting the school district folks in a position to make a decision. In some cases, they may, you know, in some cases, there are things that happen as a result. Daycares, for example, will run open or closed depending on whether or not school districts are going to be open, that sort of thing. And all these decisions and things that fall like dominoes after schools make decisions like that. And it's, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for these folks. There's not a whole lot of win-win situations, especially in situations like what we had last week.
Yep. All right, let's roll the fog bank. We'll come back with our picks of the week right after Skydaver.
Hello, Weather Brains listeners. This is Dave Phillips with the fog bank for April 15th, 2013. I'll start out with Earth Science Picture of the Day with a great rainbow photo. My second pick comes from Brad Panovich with a tweet to the link to the National Weather Service Milwaukee office showing the snow cover difference between 2012 and 2013. For my third pick, James, you need to sit on your hands and don't hit the climate change buzzer for this link. I want to remind you of your own words. Look at the science, decide for yourself. Brad Panovich put a great post on Google Plus and linked to a really good article at The Economist. I think both are worth reading. My next pick comes from the UK Met Office with an article about atmospheric research flights. And I'll close out this week from the Weather Channel with an article on large hail. Thanks for listening. Skydaver out.
Yep, and I will say that Economist article is it's a very good read. All right, we got to hurry. Picks of the week. My pick, it is the Storm Prediction Center short-range ensemble forecast products. And we're getting into the season where you start looking for severe weather tools, and that is a wonderful tool with great mapping and great options. And the links to these will be up on the weatherbrains.com site. So the SREF from SPC is my pick. And let's see if Brian Peters, the man that looks like the Colonel, has one for us this week.
Yes, I even have opinions about the school thing, but obviously
go ahead.
That's
go. You got a minute. Go. Right.
No, I don't want to be late. Sandy has been retired, and so I'm posting the my pick is the article about that.
All right, cool. Nate Johnson, your pick.
My pick of the week is a story that our science reporter Brian Schrader did on Kokoros and Kokoros in North Carolina. I hope Skydaver's listening because that pick's for you.
Ah, there you go. J.B. Elliott got a pick for us this week.
Don't have a pick, but I do have a novel opinion on the school situation.
He actually has a pick. Skydaver gave him one.
Oh, so you got a freebie on Skydaver. So
I'm in favor of the school officials keeping all the kids in the school if a big squall line is approaching until after it's over.
Yeah, that might not be a general rule. I agree, JB. All right, let's see. Kev, what's your pick?
I'm going to do two because the first one may not be wholly appropriate given the events in Boston today, but it is a good read. It's from The Guardian. It's called News is Bad for You and Giving Up Reading It Will Make You Happier. And maybe a little more weather oriented. I did find the link that Larry put up for the Arlington CASA radar. And if Brian would be so kind, he'll give me two picks of the week this week at weatherbrains.com.
Hey, Kevin.
Yes.
Sally had a text to me this morning after I forwarded your article to her. She said, Good morning, honey. Just sitting here relaxing, pumping cortisol through my body, destroying the neural pathways in my brain, dulling my creativity, developing a deep sense of fear, enjoying a worldview of depression, hopelessness, and sarcasm, a.k.a. watching The View.
Wow. Yeah, it's an interesting article. I'll be interested to hear what James has to say, too, when he reads it.
Yeah, when we have time, we need to set aside some time to talk more about schools in that article. That was a great read. But Bill Murray, what's your pick for the week?
Yeah, and again, it is a sad day. So, you know, right before the things happened in Boston, I was excited to look and see that I had 5,000 followers on Twitter. So I'm nowhere close to U-Span, but I was happy to get number 5,000 WX Nick today. So I'm shamelessly going to pimp my Twitter feed, WX Historian.
So what are you going to give this guy?
More Twitter followers than I do.
I'm going to give him a copy of the book Storm Kings that I had left over from last week.
Only have two.
Next week, our favorite Dr. John Knox will be on, and Aubrey Urbanowitz will be on the 29th, and Don Day on the 6th, the Ping Group on the 13th, and Weatherwise is Thomas Slatter on the 20th, and we've added Dr. Yvette Richardson from Penn State on May 28th if we move that event to a Tuesday. James, I guess you'll have to make that decision.
Yeah, we'll figure that out. We're going to be getting to the vacation season here, but I know one thing. It's the TV news season. Speaking of nobody watching news, I've got to go do some news over here, and probably a few people will be watching tonight because of the events in Boston. So we want to thank you for listening. Weather Brains is a weekly show. If you're new, we do this every week. We record Monday nights at 8:30 Central, 9:30 Eastern, and you can watch this live on live.bigbrainsmedia.com, and we have the video replay that's up on weatherbrains.com and other sites. And of course, most people listen by audio via podcast, your favorite podcast app. Our email address, it is email@weatherbrains.com. Our social media accounts, Twitter, Facebook, Google Plus, up on the website as well. So that'll wrap it up for this week. On behalf of the entire Weather Brains crew, I'm James Spann. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful week, and God bless.